From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, amid all the sensational headlines last year, the story of Kelly Dwyer's death that went largely untold.
Later, how librarians are playing a role in helping people with Alzheimer's and their caregivers.
Honestly, it's been a pretty easy process. Librarians, I find, already are very knowledgeable about how to communicate with others and very intuitive when it comes to working with different populations.
And pianist Orly Shaham returns to Milwaukee to perform with the MSO. She says the concert hall is one of the few places left where we can escape the pull of modern technology.
There is an understanding that we all turn off our phones, we're not going to look at them, and it may take some people a little longer, other people less time, but everybody eventually gets sucked in.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's been a little more than 3 months since Chris Zacco was convicted of reckless homicide in the death of Kelly Dwyer. The Milwaukee woman went missing in 2013, and while Zacco was a suspect for some time, it wasn't until well after Dwyer's remains were found 2 years later that he was charged.
It was a case that made headlines both locally and nationally as the trial played out, but writer Zach Brook believed that the often sensational details were obscuring another story. He shined some light on the rest of the lives that form the bigger picture in a piece in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. We should note that some of the details of this case may be disturbing to some listeners. Zach Brook joined us by phone to explain. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you again.
So there are, honestly, a lot of people, sadly, that die in tragic ways each year at the hands of someone else. What was it about this particular murder case that was especially haunting that made you want to roll up your sleeves and learn more?
Okay, well, I can tell you what did it for me personally, why Kelly Dwyer was fascinating to the Milwaukee public at large is a bit more of a mystery, but I actually met Kelly Dwyer once, very briefly, and I don't remember very much of it. I was out with friends, she was out with friends, my friends knew her friends, and I was just introduced to her. Hey, this is Kelly. Hey, I'm Zach. Hi, how are you doing? And I think that's all the interaction we had that night. And that was at the Hamilton Bar, the old Hamilton Bar, which is closed now, which is why I could write confidently in my article that she used to hang out there because I met her there. And I recall being with my partner the weekend she went missing and my partner getting texts saying, oh my God, Kelly is missing. We don't know where she is. So right off the bat, I had this real close, you know, I was real close to this story and in a way that I don't think a lot of people were. And so I knew right away I would, you know, I didn't know I'd be writing about it, but I knew I would be following it, whatever happened.
You were close to the story, but you were not close to Kelly. This is just someone that you had encountered once and this got you wondering?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, I have not had many instances in my life where somebody I met, however briefly, has gone missing or, you know, ended up meeting with, you know, a violent end and tragic circumstances. That's not something that's happened to me very much. So when it did happen, you know, it's something I took note of. Absolutely.
Well, and so this was a case that was in the headlines in a lot of places, from local news to, you know, the tabloid style national shows, the Nancy Grace show, for example. But there are, I am sure, people out there who are either new to the area or who just missed the story. Can you briefly give us a thumbnail sketch of who Kelly Dwyer was and what we initially knew about her disappearance?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, you have to cast your mind all the way back to 2013, the fall of 2013. Kelly Dwyer had just turned 28, I believe. She was really involved in the yoga community in Milwaukee. She had just, well, not just, for the past year and a half, almost close to 2 years, she was an employee at Lululemon in the Third Ward, which was a really hot brand at the time, and it was particularly exciting in her life. Talking to her father, it seems like this is the most professional success and the most like personal fulfillment she had had in a while, like as an adult. And she was just really a vibrant person who was well-loved by her friends and family. She was dating this man named Chris Zacco, although there's a dispute over like how serious they were as a couple. But the point is they were dating, and she went missing one day in October 2013. And she was last seen with Chris Zacco the night before, going out for drinks. And she was last seen by people then. And she was last seen by technology coming back into Zacco's apartment building, the Lafayette Towers. And the security camera picked them up at like 2:37 in the morning. She was never seen alive since, and no one knew what happened to her until 2015, I believe, when her body unfortunately was found in Jefferson County.
Now, you mentioned her relationship with Chris Zacco. There were, I gather, some drugs involved, and Chris Zacco was also in something of a longstanding relationship with another woman, right?
Yes, absolutely. So, I believe it came out at trial that Kelly knew that Chris Zacco was involved with someone else. Their relationship was casual. Kelly was, from what her friends and family say, hoping for something more. But at the moment, they were just enjoying a casual fling. And that part of that casual fling involved, drugs and partying. Kelly and Chris would regularly do cocaine. These are things that came out during the trial. Along with like marijuana and lots of drinking and party drugs.
Tell us more about Chris Zacco, because there are, I guess, some similarities in how both Chris Zacco's parents talk about him and how Kelly Dwyer's parents talk about her.
Chris Zacco was an East Coast transplant. Kelly was from the Chicago area before she moved up to Milwaukee. Chris was from back east. I think he grew up in Connecticut. He went to college in Boston. He did IT work with the New York Yankees. And at the time of Kelly's disappearance and death, he was working, living in Milwaukee, living at Lafayette Towers and working at a place called TRC Global, I believe. And that's where his mother was vice president. And he had some sort of middle management IT job there. She was 27. He was 38. And he did have a serious relationship, someone who did not know about Kelly at all, and that was this woman named Megan, who testified at his trial against him. And they had been together for a couple years at this point. They were not engaged, but they had brought up the discussion of marriage. Megan turned down a job in relocation in Denver, a city that she was very interested in moving to stay and cultivate this relationship with Zacco. And all that happened as Zacco was seeing Kelly on the side.
Well, and as you described Kelly Dwyer as being really pretty well liked by her group of friends, up until this point, Chris Zacco is generally well regarded as well, right?
Yeah. He played softball in this softball league, this adult softball league in Milwaukee that was frequented by a lot of like media personalities and maybe even some law enforcement people. He hung out in real professional circles thanks to his job, thanks to his girlfriend's job. People don't have a lot of bad things to say about him. I've actually talked to, and I want to make it clear. So part of his trial dealt with women who have either dated him or have sexual encounters with Chris Zacco, and they made some accusations about how scary those situations can be with him. This other Zacco comes out. But I actually talked to one who says she saw none of that, and Chris Zacco, as far as she's concerned, is a great guy. So he did have this ability to, you know, win people over. His family certainly thinks very, very highly of him. As well, like what he's capable of, like his intelligence and just his moral fiber, I guess I would say.
Well, and so you mentioned the security cameras in his building, but remind us, after Kelly Dwyer goes missing over the following months and years, actually, what is the evidence that comes out that ties Chris Zacco to Kelly Dwyer's disappearance?
So after Kelly is last seen, because she's last seen with Zocco going into his building, he is somebody that's a person of interest right away. Within days, the police have a warrant to search his apartment for any signs of her. And while they do that, one of the big thing that later came up in his trial was a cadaver dog was brought through his apartment and seized on, identified the scent of human remains in his apartment and in the parking garage by his car. So that was a big one. They also find drugs and they find a CD-ROM that contains images of child pornography. And based on, and those two things are illegal by themselves and apart from Kelly. So they arrest him on those and charge him with that. And he actually goes through trial on that for these two things. He's convicted and he's sentenced to 19 years in prison, largely on the child porn. The drugs, I think he pleads to, and that's not near as serious as the possession of child pornography. Anyways, so while he's sentenced, all this, you know, is not after he's sentenced, after he goes through trial, Kelly's body is found. Her parents never give up the search for Kelly, and they actually hire a private investigator to develop new leads and potentially identify search areas. To me, this is one of the weirdest elements of this whole saga. The private investigator hired by the Dwyers holds a press conference on April 29, 2015. Kelly's father, Tony, is also a part of this press conference. And they announce that they are holding a private search for Kelly's body within the coming week, right? So it's just something. They're not looking for the public to assist in the search. They just want the world to be aware that they haven't given up and that they have an idea where she is and they will be looking for her. I talked with the private investigator. He said they hired professional searchers. So that gives you a sense of this operation, its scale. But 2 days later, somebody unaffiliated with the search is out for a walk looking for antlers shed by deer just to like collect and display. And he comes across Kelly's remains. It's a dead end road, inland drive near Sullivan in Jefferson County. And this was on May 1st, 2 days after they hold that press conference. And that's just a striking coincidence to me. It preempted the entire search, which was just about ready to launch.
And it takes a little while to confirm that these remains are Kelly Dwyer's body, but in the end, it is a match.
Yes, it is a match. It's about a week. It's about a week before they can confirm by a dental record that it is Kelly. And the private investigator may be feeling a little put off that he wasn't able to, you know, do all this work for his client Tony Dwyer and find Kelly. He actually does a lot of legwork in finding dental records, which were hard to come by for Kelly. That could be a match. And yes, she's identified in a week, but the body is just a skeleton at this point. And there's no indication of how she died. There's no, like, they have to do soil samples to ascertain how long the body's there. Was it just dumped there, like, you know, an hour after the press conference? Had it been there for a full 18 months at this point? So yes, it's sent off to the University of Texas to conduct those tests. And it takes a whole another year before Zocco is actually charged with first-degree reckless homicide. Oh, and that's going back to the evidence collected against Zocco. If you'll recall, when they executed the search warrant, along with the cadaver dog, along with the drugs, along with the CD containing child pornography, they eventually seized a cell phone video of Chris Zocco engaging in really rough sex with Kelly Dwyer, and that became a working theory of how she died, because until then, they thought that Chris Zocco was responsible, but they didn't really know why. And this video, where she appears to be struggling breathing during this sex act, gave them a clue as to how her death occurred.
And I think you report that that other women testified that they engaged in similar acts to kind of back up this story.
Yeah, the one I'm thinking of here was a woman who is known only as Miss C. That's how she was referred to during trial. I believe she's called Witness 5 in police reports. And this is a Milwaukee area woman who used Craigslist to find a casual sex partner, ended up with Zocco, agreed. They met for coffee or whatever and talked about what they wanted to do. She agreed to it. Chris Zocco started off by respecting the conditions they agreed to. This was BDSM type stuff. And it was stuff they were both into, but involved safe words because there was an element of danger to this. And she said that Chris Zocco started respecting the system that they had to protect her safety, but later started disregarding it. And by the end, their final encounter, she alleges he straight up sexually assaulted her.
So obviously with details like this, this becomes a very sensationalized murder trial. And in the end, he's already been convicted on the drugs and child pornography charges. He's charged and convicted in Kelly Dwyer's death. This is not the end of the story, however, because it appears that some appeals may be taking place.
Chris Zocco's attorney during the initial, during the second trial, the trial for reckless homicide involving Kelly Dwyer, Craig Massatuno is the attorney's name. I spoke with him briefly, and he says he will not be representing Chris Zocco on appeal, but he believes there are grounds for one. He says that there are a couple issues involving a possible tainted jury pool, involving the cadaver dog admitted as evidence, and involving I think other issues that I can't recall off the top of my head. But he says all these might be grounds for an appeal should Chris Zocco choose to go that route. And, if we're going on history, Chris Zocco will probably choose to go that route because he's still appealing his child pornography charges that case ended, as you said, in 2014. And that's still working its way through the appellate system. So there's no reason to think that this case will not also head to appeal.
So you mentioned at the outset of this interview your one brief interaction running into to Kelly Dwyer out at the Hamilton bar. What was the hardest part of telling this story when all was said and done for you?
The hardest part was to talk with her father, who I spoke with at length. This is a man who, is hurting a lot. And but I really wanted to include his voice. And I talked to him twice, actually. So the first time I talked to him was that brief window, April 30th, 2015, that brief window, the day after they had the press conference and the day before Kelly's body was found. So when we talk about it, everything is hypothetical in terms of where's Kelly, what happened to Kelly. And then I talked to him again as the trial was going on and concluded. And, just he was a different man. But because of my conversations with him, we were able to, it just gave the story its title, Death of a Daughter, because it was, largely from his perspective. But just dealing with the parents. I've reported on a true crime before, but I don't think I've ever worked with a parent as closely as I have on this story. It's a tough balancing act because you need to be objective, but you also want to be sensitive to people that are hurting.
Right. It's easy to forget in covering a story like this about the real lives that are in kind of the orbit of the people involved.
Yeah, absolutely. But sitting through the trial, and I didn't watch every witness, but I watched a good deal of it. Kelly was really well-loved. So many of her former coworkers who, hadn't worked with her in 5 years at that point showed up. Her manager testified. She's just a person that people really liked. And, it's nothing but a tragedy.
Well, Zach Brook, thank you so much for telling the story and for sharing it with us.
Hey, thank you.
Zach Brook is a freelance writer and contributor to Milwaukee Magazine. His article on Kelly Dwyer's death and the subsequent conviction of Chris Zocco is in the current issue. You'll find a link to more at WUWM.com.
We will take a quick break now and then learn how a group of libraries in southeastern Wisconsin is working to improve the lives of people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia and their caregivers. More about that story after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Around 5.7 million Americans live with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, and that number is expected to skyrocket in the next 30 years. Dementia can be very isolating, both for patients and their caregivers. In addition to memory loss, people can experience trouble communicating, poor judgment, and personality changes.
But one organization is trying to make those dealing with dementia a little less isolated. The Library Memory Project is a partnership between public libraries in Waukesha, Milwaukee, and Dodge counties. Its programs target both those affected by memory loss and their caregivers.
Each month, the library hosts a memory cafe as a fun social opportunity in a safe, supportive, and judgment-free space for those experiencing early-stage dementia and for their families, friends, and care partners. Tomorrow morning, the Bridges Library System launches its fifth library memory project in the Mukwonago Community Library.
Jennifer Harders is the outreach coordinator for the Alzheimer's Association of Southeast Wisconsin, and Angela Myers is coordinator of youth and inclusive services for the Bridges Library System. Myers explained to Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski why memory cafes are an ideal approach for the people they serve.
So I actually learned about memory cafes through a library conference session that I went to, and we were sitting there in the audience, director and I, and we said, we have to do this. This is something that our community definitely needs. And memory cafes are for persons with memory loss and their care partners to come together and have social interactions with other people going through the same experience or similar journey. So that was really the idea that sparked this in 2014. And then we brought the idea back to a few more libraries, and that's how we began the first set of memory cafes.
You know, when it comes to library programs, you know, I always think of the time when my mom took me and my sisters to the library for like a magic show, learn about creatures, story time, crafts, you know, all of these activities that made it more than just a place to get some books. And adults really need the same thing too. So what is it that makes a library a perfect environment for a program like this?
Well, I think that libraries serve everybody from birth until they're 100 years old. So we offer programs for all ages. And that's where this is a perfect fit for people who are experiencing memory loss. And it's a place where they feel welcome, and it's a comfortable place for them to return to.
And how do you facilitate and create a safe space that's judgment-free?
Well, we actually work with the Alzheimer's Association and the Aging and Disability Resource Center to provide dementia-friendly training for our library staff and volunteers. So that has gone a long way in helping people understand who our service population is.
And Jennifer, could you go into that a little bit? What kind of things are you teaching library staffers to keep in mind?
Yeah. So in part of that education, we're talking about what is dementia? What is Alzheimer's disease? What's the difference between the two? We also talk about how to recognize when somebody might be having some memory loss issues. People typically don't announce that. So we teach them how to recognize those folks. And then we talk about effective communication, because when somebody has Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia, it impacts how they communicate their thoughts, how they understand communication from others. So in addition to that, they're learning how to communicate with others. And honestly, it's been a pretty easy process. Librarians, I find, already are very knowledgeable about how to communicate with others and very intuitive when it comes to working with different populations.
Yeah, librarians are unique in that a part of their job a lot is communication and face-to-face time. But what do you think the public misconceptions are when it comes to understanding dementia and Alzheimer's? And to backtrack a bit, how you mentioned, you know, what is the difference between the two?
So Alzheimer's disease is a form of dementia. Dementia is this umbrella, broad term that describes changes in memory, changes in thought process, often changes in language, how we understand language, but also how we communicate ourselves. And so it's this broad term. And then underneath that, if you think of it as kind of an umbrella, there are different types. Alzheimer's disease is one type of dementia. It's the most common type, making up 60-80% of all dementias. There's also other types of dementia, like vascular dementia, frontal temporal dementia, Lewy body dementia. At the Alzheimer's Association, although we are the Alzheimer's Association, we serve individuals with any type of dementia. So that's part of the education that we provide, too, is not only how to recognize somebody with Alzheimer's disease, but how to recognize somebody who might have other forms of dementia.
And do you think the number of seniors with dementia-related illnesses is growing in the United States as a matter of being more aware of the different types of dementia people can be experiencing, or do you think it's other factors that can contribute?
Part of it is awareness, but a big part of it is that our population is aging. Alzheimer's disease, for the most part, is a disease that affects older adults. At the age of 65, 1 in 8 or 1 in 9 individuals have Alzheimer's disease, and by the time we're 85, it's 1 in 3. So the older we get, the greater the chances that we're going to have Alzheimer's disease. So it is a higher prevalence with the older adults.
And besides the loss of memory, which people can easily understand, what other kinds of aspects of life do people lose when going through this?
Well, like I said, that the whole communication piece, one of the things that I do for the Alzheimer's Association is I work with individuals who are early stage. So similar to the individuals that would come to a memory cafe, I facilitate a support group for early stage folks. And many of those individuals in that group will say, I know what I want to say, but I can't get it out. So really learning how to help those folks communicate, that can really impact their lives in tremendous ways. So besides that memory impairment, not being able to remember things that happened this morning or yesterday, not being able to fully articulate thoughts can be challenging for these folks.
And I imagine there's also isolation is a big issue.
Yes, and that is one of the big reasons the memory cafes actually began, was because 70% of individuals who have Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia live in the community. We often think of these folks as living in care facilities, but majority of them are living in the community. And what we do know based on research is that these individuals and their loved ones become very isolated. I've had people tell me that they've lost friends that they've had for years because people don't know how to interact and how to be with that person. So the memory cafes actually have formed a great social network for these people. And Angela can tell you that we will see people come to cafes on opposite ends of the county because it's a social connection for them and they build friendships. Oftentimes, they'll see each other outside of the regular scheduled memory cafes because they just enjoy being together so much and they understand what each other's going through.
Right. And Angela, can you walk us through what does your average memory cafe gathering look like month to month? You know, is there somewhat of a lesson plan that you guys have followed or activities that are specifically catered to this group of people?
Sure. So every month our librarians actually come up with a theme for the different memory cafes because librarians love planning. So this is totally, you know, in their arena. So what they do is they come up with an idea for a certain topic. So for the memory cafe that's coming up on Thursday the 24th, the topic is actually called Football Fun. So everything about that memory cafe is going to be about football, whether it's talking about what snacks we typically eat when we gather for football games or who your favorite college or professional team is. We're going to pass around some different artifacts from a high school team just so people can kind of feel what a football feels like and feel what a jersey feels like, that sort of thing. It's really important for us to hit on those different senses for people because that's really what kind of enlightens them and kind of sparks a mood. So it's really important for us to incorporate different elements during the memory cafe. So there's this social interaction that happens when they first get there. Everyone comes in and gets their coffee, gets a cookie or a treat, that sort of thing. They sit down, they talk to their friends, and then we slowly move into the theme or the program. And that lasts for about 45 minutes. And then we start closing the memory cafe. And we often talk about, like, what is everybody doing outside of the memory cafe? And it kind of gives people other ideas of what else is kind of safe to go to or of interest. And people seem to really like that. And then we always close the memory cafe with either a poem or a song. And it just kind of gives that closure to the memory cafe. And for those who do have memory loss, I think it helps having that schedule of events so that they know what to expect at each memory cafe.
Right. And in addition to the people you're serving with memory loss, I imagine you get a lot of caretakers coming here with them. So what kind of impact or things have they learned by coming together
Well, we do notice that we have a lot of husband and wife pairs, or we might have sons that bring their mothers, that sort of thing. And what we notice that the caregivers actually tend to, they're attracted to one another in a way because they like to share what's going on with their loved one's life, what kind of treatment they're doing, what other activities they're going to. And I think it's been a real nice connection for the caregivers as well as the persons living with memory loss.
Jennifer, I imagine outside of what the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Association does, when someone is diagnosed with a memory loss type disease, do the resources and the next steps kind of fall flat?
What we hear often for those individuals is once they're diagnosed, they're told by the doctor's office that they have Alzheimer's disease or other form of dementia, and then they're told to come back in 6 months to a year. So we have a program that's called the Direct Connect program where we talk with doctors, clinics in the area, and we provide them a sheet that they can complete with that person, and they fax it to us or email it to us, and then it gives us permission to reach out to the families. We know on average if that family or that individual is left with just our number, it will take them up to 2 years to get connected with us. So this is an easier way as they're learning about the disease process and starting to come to terms with what might be ahead, that we can get in contact with them and literally walk that journey with them, get them information, education about the disease process, help them plan. A lot of my time is spent directly with individuals with memory loss and their loved ones doing what we call care consultations. I meet people where they're at. I'll go into their home. I'll meet them at a local library, talk about what their biggest issues or concerns are, provide information about the disease process, and then help them get connected to the resources. So the memory cafes are one great way to do that. The individual with memory loss comes with a care partner. And as Angela said, sometimes you'll literally see that care partner sit back and just kind of take a deep breath and relax because they don't have to be on. There are the facilitators that will help engage those folks. Other times you'll see the care partners develop friendships and you'll see them chatting with other care partners. Sometimes you'll see the persons living with dementia develop friendships, and they'll always try and sit next to one another because they've come to know each other through the memory cafes.
This question is for the both of you. What is the greatest feedback you've gotten with these cafes?
I think the greatest feedback we've had so far is keep offering them or offer more. And like Jen said earlier, people will literally drive across the county from Menominee Falls to Eagle to attend a memory cafe because those are their friends now. And that's the stuff that they're looking forward to. And it's something to have on the calendar. And that they know when they go there, they're going to be welcome and they're going to have a good time and they're going to maintain those connections.
I think for me, it was with a group that was impacted pretty early on when the cafes first started happening in Waukesha, Milwaukee County. And the individuals in this group have come to us and said, prior to the memory cafes, prior to the services that they were receiving, they felt very isolated. They felt very disconnected from friends they had had for years, from families. And actually, through the diagnosis and their loved one having Alzheimer's disease or other form of dementia, they found a new family. They found these friends through the memory cafes that they now see each other on a regular basis. They celebrate children's and grandchildren's weddings together. They celebrate the birth of children together. We've seen this, that this is a new family for these folks, and it's priceless for them.
What can we do better for people who are not directly impacted by dementia or Alzheimer's, who don't realize that we're not communicating properly or we're not fostering a welcoming environment, even when it comes to shared public spaces?
I think to raise our awareness. Currently, there are 5.7 million Americans living with Alzheimer's disease, and by the year 2050, we're expecting nearly 14 million individuals. So if you yet have not been impacted by Alzheimer's disease, it's very likely that you will be in the future. So I think learning more about it, learning more about how to recognize the signs, and being open to discussions about what that looks like, being open to having discussions about your with your family members, even if you're not seeing it yet, there is a likelihood that you may in the future.
I would also add that the Alzheimer's Association offers a lot of educational programs for the general population, and one of them that I really enjoy is Know the 10 Signs. And that one is really intended for folks who have not received that diagnosis yet, that are just looking to learn more about Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. And it's really about just kind of getting people in the know.
Well, Angela and Jennifer, thank you both for coming in today and for the work that you're doing with Memory Cafes.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Jennifer Harders is the Outreach Coordinator for the Alzheimer's Association of Southeast Wisconsin. Angela Myers is the Coordinator of Youth and Inclusive Services for the Bridges Library System of Waukesha and Jefferson Counties.
They spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. The Bridges Library System launches its fifth library memory project tomorrow morning at the Maquonago Community Library. You can learn more about memory cafes and learn more about dementia at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break and then chat with pianist Orly Shaham. She'll perform with the Milwaukee Symphony this weekend. Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Pianist Orly Shaham returns to Milwaukee this weekend after a three-year absence, but the piece she'll perform, Béla Bartók's Piano Concerto No. 3, is the same one that brought her here in 2016. It is a piece that was written at the end of Bartók's life and is romantic in a way that a lot of Bartók isn't.
We reached Shaham by Skype to learn more about the concerto and about the joys of making music in our electronic age. Orly Shaham, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to come back to Milwaukee. Although, you know, whenever I tell people Milwaukee in January, they look at me like maybe I made a mistake.
We're so thrilled to have you back to play the Bartók Third. And this piece, I just was listening to it this morning to refresh my memory. It had been a while since I'd listened to it. And it is so melodic. It is not what a lot of people think of when they think of Bartók.
No, and I think, you know, one of the things that draws me always to this piece. This was a very late piece, in fact, one of his very last pieces. And he knew that this was the end of his life. And it has a quality to it, which I think certain creators, writers and composers get near the end of their life, where really there's an economy of means. There's an ability to express so much with so little in a way that is so powerful. And this piece is very much, it's distilled down to its essences. There are not too many notes thrown at you. It's very clean lines, almost Mozartian in the way that he handles both the piano and the orchestra. And yet it is just so emotive and so emotional. It's filled with all sorts of energy that touches every part of you in such a clear, clean way.
It was a gift, wasn't it? Wasn't it a gift for his wife?
It was a gift for his wife. You know, he knew that his life was ending, and he actually wrote it for her and for her to play, in part because he was worried that she would need a source of income after he died, and he wanted her to have this piece to play. And not surprisingly, in the world of the 1940s, she was hardly the one who played it the most. She wasn't even the one who ended up playing it first. It was, of course, a man who did that.
Did she end up earning money from it?
Some, but I think nowhere near what he had hoped would happen.
Well, you mentioned Mozart. The piece is so melodic. And yes, Bartók was always using Hungarian folk tunes in a lot of his orchestral works and other pieces and his other piano pieces. But there's something about this that is incredibly lush and melodic. There's a little atonality, but not a lot. And it's so, what's the word I want? It lets you in so easily.
Absolutely. I feel like, you know, the first movement, it's really like a folktale. So in the sense of not necessarily even using Hungarian themes, although there are some musical ideas that way, it takes you in as if somebody is telling you a folk story. And the piano begins right at the beginning in octaves, sort of explaining this story, letting you in, setting the scene. It's quite dramatic in that way. And of course, Bartók had written dramatically many times for ballets and for other theatrical settings. So there is that feeling in the first movement. I like throughout, and a beautiful dialogue between the piano and the orchestra. Some really well thought out orchestration where there's, you know, just enough color coming from the orchestra without ever being overwhelming to what the piano's doing. Yeah. And the second movement is this gorgeous, gorgeous prayer. It's clearly somebody writing at the end of their lives, but it's so personal and intimate. It sounds like one person trying to speak to the universe. Really stunning.
I agree with you that there is that sort of sense of longing and reaching in that second movement. And it's just, you just sort of sink into it.
Yeah. And, you know, in the middle of the second movement, there's a central section, which is very typical Bartok, what he and others refer to as night music, the kind of the sounds you hear, maybe animals, things that might be moving around in the night. Quite beautiful, bringing everything back into the natural world.
This is the second time that you've returned to Milwaukee to play the same concerto. Is that an unusual thing?
It is, actually. You know, the piano repertoire is so huge, and I play fairly regularly about 40 different concertos, so it's unusual for me to come back and play the same piece, but it'll be with a different conductor this time, and I had such a great pleasure last time working with the orchestra on this. I'm really looking forward to hearing them again and collaborating with them again on it.
When you approach a piece that you've played before, and most soloists will play the same pieces more than once in their careers, they'll play them often, but how do you approach it again? How do you keep it fresh for yourself?
You know, for me, a piece like this is so rich. I feel very lucky to be able to explore it again and again. Every time I come back to it, I find new and surprising things, you know, connections where I think, how did I not see that before? And this is the great thing about playing the kind of music that I do. You know, there is such richness there. There are so many layers to, you know, you can peel off so much of this onion that it provides a lifetime's work. You never get the feeling that you're coming back and, oh, not this again. You know, there's always more to be found in it.
Well, and you mentioned a different conductor. And of course, the orchestra will have changed too. There are some new players, people have retired. And so even though the sound might be very similar, it's not going to be exactly the same.
It never is. And I, even from one performance to the next, you know, when we do two or three performances on a weekend, they're really not the same performance. There's something about the particular day and where the musician's been, and especially that particular audience and the kind of listening that you get back from the audience. It really does impact how you play. This is what makes live performance so exciting to me. You know, recording has many virtues, and I enjoy recording very much, but it doesn't have that feeling of, you know, this is being created at the moment, and whatever happens, happens.
Well, you talked about the quality of listening, and there's a lot of talk these days about how people in our world don't have the ability to sit quietly and listen anymore. We're so distracted by our electronic gizmos and other things pulling at us. Do you find that to be true once you get into the concert hall and you actually have an audience there?
You know, that's a great question. I feel that the concert hall is one of the few havens we have from that sort of thing at the moment, because there is an understanding that we all turn off our phones, we're not going to look at them, and it may take some people a little longer, other people less time, but everybody eventually gets sucked in. I had a great experience just a few days ago in Los Angeles. I was playing as part of my shows that I do for kids. Then I played a Mozart sonata for a group of kids, you know, between the ages of maybe 2 and 12 and their parents and grandparents. And in about 10 seconds of starting this Mozart sonata, they were all completely engrossed. And that experience is, it happens time and time again. That kind of deep focus that you do in the listening is so satisfying.
Well, it's really gratifying to hear that young children, who everyone is so worried about, you know, being sucked into the phones, that they're the ones who are like just rapt when you are playing. I mean, that to me, that's very heartening.
Well, you know, it says what I think we've always known, which is this music is great. There's no issues with the quality of what it is that we're doing. And it's really a matter of making sure that people are exposed to it, and in particular, that they're exposed to it in such a way that they know that it's there for them, that it's not somebody else's music, but it is something that will be heard and be effective specifically for them.
Do you think that orchestras and, well, musicians specifically, but also organizations, whether it's chamber music or orchestral, are people and organizations doing that better? Are they reaching out? Because classical music always had a reputation of being somewhat elitist. Whether you agreed with it or not, that was sort of the popular culture idea about it. I've never felt that way, but I know a lot of people who do.
I don't think elite is a bad word. I think it's good, actually, to do something at the height of how you can do that thing. But to be elitist is the problem, right? Is to say, well, I have this thing and you can't have it. And I do feel that classical music has changed very much from that. There's a feeling now of there's so many people out there who you can reach and who amazingly want to be reached. It's really just a question of getting the music in the right places and in the right ways for them to access.
Yeah, and it's more than just taking the orchestra out of formal clothing. You know, there's other ways of engaging people where they are.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of it has to do with sort of concert hall etiquette and being able to give people access points, talking about the music in a way that somebody who may feel that they didn't have the right training nevertheless feels that they can come into it in some way. It varies from audience to audience. It varies from hall to hall and from organization to organization. The issue is across the board, and I think not just in this country, but really around the world. But the answers, the solutions are site-specific and they are organization-specific. And it has to do, we are communication from people to people. And in the end, individuals make up those groups of people, and you have to figure out what works best.
One of the ways you've done that, in addition to your playing, is that you've been on the side of the microphone where I am, and you've done things for NPR. How does reaching that kind of an audience help you get into the concert hall, or once you get into the concert hall?
I think that people who listen to the radio and so who are already attuned to the idea of using getting information primarily through your ears are sort of the perfect fit for us, right? This is what we're all about. There's some interesting visual things happening when you come to a concert, but the main thing that is so unique and so different from your everyday life is the incredible things that come through sound.
Yeah. A friend years ago when I was first getting into radio called it brain to brain and heart to heart.
It's that, very lovely.
That direct Absolutely. Connection. You know, you kind of bypass all the intellect in some ways, and you just get right to the meat of it.
Well, and the other thing that I love about this kind of concert, and this is true really for most types of live events, is here we are on stage and we're communicating with the audience as a whole, but each individual member of that audience is having their own unique experience, which is absolutely true and complete. And it's somehow the fact that all these individuals having those experiences at the same time heightens that experience for all of us, you know, for the performers as well as the listeners.
There's something about, I think, seeing, you know, that wide-eyed sense or feeling that wide-eyed sense of wonder when you're touched, whether you're a little kid or whether you're an old person, it doesn't matter, of just being touched in that way.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, with music, it often surprises us. You know, we think as species. We tend to think linguistically, and we tend to think that it's all about things we can verbalize. Suddenly, there are these things that touch us in a completely different way that we couldn't even put words to if we tried. That gets to a part of our humanity we may not reach quite as often.
Or maybe any other way.
Mm.
Well, we are so looking forward to having you back. It's been 3 years. It'll be nice to have you back on stage with the Milwaukee Symphony, Orly. And I thank you so much for taking a little time to talk with us today about music, about Bartok, and just about the joy of making music.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm excited to come back.
Pianist Orly Shaham performs Béla Bartók's Piano Concerto No. 3 with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra this weekend. You can find dates and times at WUWM.com. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.